I'm Christopher Lydon with Nell Irvin Painter, the historian of white people, of whiteness, of the invisible norm, the pigmentation that assigns colors to other people but can't see its own. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. This one with the artist and writer Nell Painter, who's emerita at Princeton. She flips the ethnographic mirror on white America now that we're all supposed to know the genomics of it, that race is a social concept, not a scientific one, a construction, not a fact. She's asking, so who invented whiteness as a human category? Who expanded it and shrank it from time to time? White, of course, became the code for Anglo-Saxon beauty, intelligence, and power. What's left of it in 2010 when our icons of beauty, intelligence, and power are, above all, our radiant brown President Barack Hussein Obama and his First Lady Michelle Obama? Nell Painter, where are we now in the history of white people? Do you want to give us the short form, going back to the Greeks and their color distinctions, which seem to devalue the white Scythians nearby?
Well, they didn't devalue the white Scythians because they were white. They devalued them because they were barbarians. So whiteness didn't mean anything particular. It's how they lived, where they lived. Being white became an object of curiosity when Europeans encountered other people, notably when they encountered lots of other people and subjected them in various ways. So I date the rise of race thinking from 1795, when Jan Friedrich Blumenbach applied the word Caucasian to white people because of their dazzling beauty.
Why the Germans? My reflex would be to blame it on the Brits as part of their own empire building, dividing, conquering, and devaluing, using the power of their own paleness.
The Brits did praxis. The Germans did theory. Why were they doing it? Because they lived the life of the mind. And they were all thinking about how to make sense of this larger world. They were categorizing. They were building on Linnaeus.
It was the British who learned how to use it in the British Isles and then the world. Give us the British piece of the use of racial division.
There's a very big story about the British piece that is not my story. And that is the British in India, the British in the Caribbean, the British in South Africa. My story is the English in England proposing themselves as a different race from the Celts. If you want the colonial story, the backstory for my book, it's Ireland, because we recognize the Irish as white people. But in the 19th century and the late 18th century, they were racialized as the Celtic race, as an inferior race of people who went forth into battle and always lost.
These are my people.
Well, actually, they are the people of millions and millions of Americans who consider themselves of all backgrounds now. Any American with roots into the 19th century is part Irish, because the Irish were the great sort of working class. So Irish and German are kind of our basic white people stuff. Mm. And those of us who have hundreds of ancestors in North America have that. We're all mixed up. Anybody can be racialized. We have a manifold choices in human difference. So we could build a race on the shape of the nose. In the 19th and 20th century, races were built in the shape of the head.
Mm.
So you can use anything. And whether it's what we now see as a big difference or what we now see as a small difference, the point is to show that the people who are at the bottom, who do the dirty work, paid, unpaid, are there because of something inside them, intrinsic in them, and permanent.
Mm. phrenology, of course, the shapes of heads, mm-hmm. has been exploded many times. We come to the age of the genome and a realization, which I think is getting pretty common now, mm-hmm. that we're all almost exactly yeah. the same stuff.
Yeah.
And the human brain is almost absolutely the same thing. A sort of, I think of it as a kind of universal carburetor that was tested and proven and improved and then uh-huh. sent out from uh-huh. East Africa, uh-huh. what, 50, 75,000 years
yeah.
ago.
And the point is that they kept walking and they kept migrating. People have not stopped moving. People are still moving. They're still moving. They're still meeting. They're still having sex and they're still having babies. And their babies are growing up and having more sex.
Have you had your DNA tested?
No.
Will you?
No.
I keep waiting to get around to doing it myself.
Why would you do that?
Well, two things. Well, first, the reason I don't. The Leidens come from...
It's expensive.
Well, that's three.
This is a very good reason not to do it.
But the Leidens come from Connemara, and my notion has always been that, you know, they just migrated gradually and got out to the end of the earth and stayed
well,
there
you
forever.
Know, one line of my Leidens came from Connemara, but what about your
other
300 Joyce's, ancestors?
Well, that's what keeps me interested, and yeah. I got to do it sometime.
But I know, but DNA testing will not tell you about your other 320 or 1,000 ancestors, because by the time you get back into the point where you have hundreds of ancestors, which is very fast, everything gets all mushed up. So what the DNA testers do is pick out something that, according to the laws of probability, seems possible and would make you happy that you spent all that money.
I want them to give me a route map out of East Africa.
I know.
Across
they cannot
the Suez
do that.
And, you know,
they cannot do that.
Are we
going
to go
I'm
left
sorry.
To
no,
France
no,
or right
no,
to
no.
Borneo?
Impossible.
What do you learn, Nell Painter, from the stories of Skip Gates or Oprah Winfrey, who turn out to be this percent Jewish or that
yeah.
percent
yeah.
Bulgarian?
Yeah, that we're all related, but I knew that before.
Nothing more? Right?
Well, for me, what I am is what my parents made me and what I have made of myself.
Hmm.
It's not my DNA.
Nell Painter, tell us your own story. How did you come to an understanding that you are not your DNA and that your future, your career, your mind, your writing are not your past?
Golly. I feel that I have been so fortunate in my life. I am a Black American woman born in the 1940s. And there, but for the grace of God, I might have gone in many directions and fallen prey to many dangers. And my family and my own blundering way through life have preserved me. I am conscious of having worked very hard in my life. And the book that you have before you is a lot of work.
My
DNA was not out there tracking down those sources in Firestone Library for me.
But what were the steps by which you came to, dare I say, an Emersonian, self-reliant, do-it-yourself, trust thyself, follow the gleam in your own mind from
yeah.
within, as he
yeah.
said, that stance to life?
Probably it goes back to my childhood.
Where in?
Oakland, California. I come from a very ordinary it would be ordinary as an American family, but it was relatively well-off as a Black American family. My parents were college graduates, and my mother's father was a college teacher who married one of his students. Part of my genealogy is people who were free before 1865. Part of it, of course, is people who were not free before 1865. And part of it is people who, for whom slavery and freedom was not part of their lives.
Mm-hmm.
growing, I'm glad that my parents left Texas when I was a child. I mean, it's 10 weeks old. I'm glad they didn't bring me up in the South. I escaped the rigors of segregation. I grew up in what I see as a white supremacist United States, but it was not at its worst in Oakland, California.
Mm.
My parents had lots of friends like them, so it never seemed strange to me. I mean, I always assumed that I would go to college, and I think I always assumed that I would have a higher education. My father was chief technician of chemistry at the University of California for many, many years, so I kind of grew up on the Berkeley campus, and that's the only place I ever wanted to go to college. I thought people went to Stanford because they couldn't get in Berkeley.
One of the things that kept me going through your book was your war on Ralph Waldo Emerson, who happens to be a hero of mine.
It's not a war.
And yet you call him, Emerson that is, the philosopher king of American white race theory. And I want to
These two
I want to
are
that.
Not in in contradiction. You can be both.
How so?
Well, Emerson was a great thinker. He's the embodiment of the American Renaissance. That doesn't mean that he didn't have some things that he said that have not worn well. I don't deny him his greatness. I just talk about some other things that have fallen by the wayside.
I don't ever get from Emerson your picture of a champion of imperial whiteness. I mean, he was an abolitionist. He thought, he compared John Brown to Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. He opposed the annexation of Texas and the war with Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking for the roots of your animus.
I don't have an animus against him. I'm not looking to tear him down. I'm looking perhaps to fill him out a little more.
I just want to get clear on Emerson because he is, to me, a very contemporary 2010 model of where we want to go. I also associate him in his circle with Melville, whose model of the Pequod and sailors, expert sailors from 40 nations or plus, is such a model of where we've got to go, and I think we are going. But also the connection with Whitman and others, universal thinkers. I just don't want to believe that my guy Emerson is reducible to
any kind of narrow chauvinism.
He
is not reducible to narrow chauvinism.
Phew.
And I hope I have made that extremely clear in my chapters. He is not reducible to narrow chauvinism, but there is a part of Emerson that goes in that direction.
Was that on his off days or phases of his life, or was this just experimentalism, you know, at the writing table?
No, it was it's a theme that runs throughout the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s. He started giving his lectures on the genius of the English and the Anglo-Saxon race in the 30s. And he gave them through the 30s and the 40s and the 50s. And by the 60s, he was even getting a little tougher. So I don't know if you want to embrace the Emerson, the late Emerson, in terms of his thinking about the human race. He got to be pretty cranky.
I think you're right. I think there's also more irony in his celebration of the English than maybe you credit him. Where's the definition of white people, the white American, going in this 21st century, Nell Painter?
In our two censuses, if you count 2000 as 21st century, certainly 2010, we still have a box a box called white. Will it be there in 2020? Probably. What I find really interesting is the people I've been talking to since my book came out. Invariably, there are white people who express discomfort at having to check a white box, either because they don't feel white or they don't want to embrace what they see as a repressive identity, or they don't want to further the racialization of our population for various reasons. And there, I think I'm seeing an expression of whiteness moving from being unmarked and invisible, as you noted in your intro, into being a race among others, and perhaps as slipshod as race among others. After all, the race has always been used very loosely, and it's used very loosely for white people as it is for other people.
What about the white head, the white consciousness? Can
I don't think there's any such thing.
Well, I'm thinking of me. Can I?
Okay. You know, speak of yourself.
Can people I went to college with?
Can you speak of yourself? You sound like my husband.
No, I'm thinking of the white guys I went to Yale with in the 60s.
Uh-huh.
Can we get over being a footnote?
That's always been the case.
But we didn't know it, and nobody was going to tell us either.
People have told you.
They'll tell us with a new, with more and more authority.
They'll tell you and you'll listen.
Yeah. maybe that's the news. But I'm kidding when I say, can we take it? But then what?
Yeah, but some of you can and some of you can't. Clearly, we live in a country in which thousands of people are having a lot of trouble with it. But also millions of people say, okay, this is the world we're in. One thing that's really interesting that's changing how Euro-Americans are getting through life is that people of our generation, the grandparent generation, have an array of grandchildren.
Me too.
And our grandchildren do not necessarily look like us.
Praise God. To me, one of the most interesting stories here unfolding out of your history is Barack Obama.
Mm-hmm.
And especially that he seems to be back in the saddle after the healthcare victory.
Mm-hmm.
We can still call it the age of Obama. But to me, the question from the beginning is, what has this extraordinarily gifted man absorbed not only from his complex parentage, but from college right after the civil rights movement,
mm-hmm.
30 years now of black studies in American mm-hmm. campuses, mm-hmm. race studies, gender studies. What is he drawing on as his fundamental conception, not mm-hmm. just of who he is, but mm-hmm. of what the world is mm-hmm. and what whiteness is, what mm-hmm. what race connotes and where he's going?
Well, you know, I think that's a fascinating set of questions, which I'm assuming that he will answer after his presidency. He's a wonderful writer, so we'll have to wait a little while to hear from him.
But even in his presidency.
But what I'm hearing and seeing and finding absolutely fascinating is what millions of Americans are seeing and thinking about what he means. And I'll give you one example. To have one parent of African ancestry, closer or farther, and one parent of European ancestry, closer or farther, is something that's been part of our country's history from long before we became a nation.
Mm.
It probably started happening in 1620, the first Africans coming in 1619. People have sex. People have children. And there have been people of what we now call biracial or multiracial heritage forever.
Mm.
They have been called Negroes, colored people, Afro-Americans, African-Americans, or black. Or they have been just white people. What's so interesting to me is that Americans are now beginning to be able to say, golly, there are people whose parents are black and white. Wow. People like Barack Obama have always been with us. We have not always been able to see them as biracial people.
Fascinating. It reminds me, I read Moby Dick again last summer.
Uh-huh,
for
uh-huh.
the first time, it broke through to me as a different story. And this is with the help of C.L.R. James,
mm-hmm.
but the hero of that story is the crew.
Uh-huh.
And Queequeg embodies them.
Yeah.
But there's a moment, I think it's chapter 41, there's this dance, celebration night, when everybody does their thing. And
yeah.
he lists the sailors
different
from
kinds
all
of dances.
Over the world.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the music and
yeah.
the variety.
Yeah.
And in the larger story, Ahab, of course, is wacko, but these nice three New England white officers cannot contain him and don't stop the disaster. It's the crew that almost does, that might have, mm-hmm. but they're the embodiment of the transnation, the intermarried, multicolor, South Sea, you know, Scandinavian, Irish, English, everywhere people. It seemed to be a perfect model and example for the age of Obama of who we always were in our best dream of ourselves. And this was 1851 or whenever Melville published Moby Dick.
Yeah. One of the things I learned in the book I did before this one, which is Creating Black Americans, is that when Melville was writing, great numbers of black men were working on the water, either working at sea or working in rivers or along the coasts. Mm-hmm. That seafaring was a major African-American occupation. What you left out of your nice version was that the people who worked in whaling were very much oppressed as workers.
Yeah,
and one of
work.
The reasons they couldn't turn that ship around or change it was their power relationship, that they were kind of the proletariat in a way.
Mm-hmm.
So, and as you point out, working people have always been very mixed up.
In the trials of the Obama presidency, more and more people, I think, want to see his difficulties with health care, his difficulty with Tea Party folk, as a response fundamentally to race and to color.
I think fundamentally that's correct, because the line is basically a states' rights argument, and states' rights has a long genealogy back into the 19th century, and it has been, leave us alone so we can oppress them.
Mm-hmm.
So if it weren't states' rights, I would have more difficulty. Perhaps I've targeted it too easily. But it seems to me that the complex of issues and their behavior has a racist edge to it.
Hmm. One of the great lessons about whiteness is how fluid it is, how much it changes now as ever in the past. What's your own sense of where we're going? What's your dream of where this country might be going in its sense of color, race, difference?
Mm-hmm. I think in this time of rampant inequality, where you do have a sort of multicultural, tiny upper class, upper middle class, that in the circles of wealth and power, they are much more heterogeneous than they were in the past. However, the people who were just scraping by or who were not scraping by, those people will remain racialized and probably largely racialized as black. Many of them will be black and brown because those are the people who get set back in times of economic trouble as we are in now. So that is to say that on the one hand, race is less important, whiteness is less important than it was, say, a generation ago or two generations ago. Remember, in the 20th century, a beautiful woman who looked white could have her life dashed if somebody discovered she had a drop of black blood, this invisible ruination of white privilege. So I think whiteness will be less important. It already is less important. But wealth, much more important. That we will always have a category that is summed up as black or Negro or colored or whatever that will contain all the stigma of the past races, be they Celtic races or the Jewish race when it was poor working people, the Italian race when it was poor working people, the Slavic race when it was poor working people. We will always have that sense of race.
Mm.
Our culture, our country was founded as a slaveholding republic in which it was racialized. If you were black, you were slave, and if you were white, you were free. It will take us generations to get over that and to get away from that, especially as the face of poverty is a brown or black face.
It'll take not just generations, it'll take effort, it'll take leadership, it'll take standards and goals. Guide us.
Well, I think one thing we want to keep our eyes on is the injuries of class when class means poor. Because there are so many injuries, be they psychological or economic or physical, we discover that obesity is linked to income and wealth. And we discover that poor health has to do with where you live. Part of the DNA stuff was trying to trace down the genetic roots of illness. And it turns out that the class roots of illness are much more important, be they asthma or heart disease. So I would like us to pay much more attention to the class bases of discrimination or ill health or cutting off life's opportunities.
Now, Peter, thank you for this book. Thank you for this consciousness raising for me. And thank you for this conversation.
Well, thank you. You got really good questions. Thank you.
Good answers. Nell Painter, thank you. Paul McCarthy and Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over till listeners add their two bits in comments on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the conversation.